Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find three separate speaker feeds with over 200 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active.
I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Amy.
Hi, I'm Amy. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi,
Amy. Hi. Oh, I'm really nervous to share at this meeting. Thank you, Atisa, for asking me to speak and for trusting that I have enough recovery to be here when I don't often trust that I have that. It really helped me to have that conversation with you and to feel like I do have something to share and some experience, strength, and hope. Because I think because I don't do it perfectly, I don't deserve to tell my story, and I don't deserve to call myself abstinent, and I don't deserve a lot of things because I'm not in the body I think I should be in, and because my food doesn't always look like it should, and because my head doesn't talk to me or think the way I think it should, and my feelings aren't what I think they should be, and it goes on and on and on. So I'm really grateful to be here tonight. And just to let you know kind of time-wise where I am in... been in program over 3 years. I have about 2.5 years of abstinence. I got abstinent right away when I came in, and for me, abstinence at first looked like no sugar anywhere. I could not have a bit of sugar because it took me out so quickly. So it was no sugar, and that was it. That was all I could do for a while. And now it's still no sugar, although now I can have like ketchup and I don't like throw myself off a bridge. And no binging. So, what it was like. I was thinking today about, like, okay, so what was it like? When did all this madness start? And I don't know. I'm like, it's sort of like, well, I came out this way. You know, what can I tell you? I've been a compulsive overeater since I had any consciousness of being a person. You know, and I started when I was a kid. You know, and I think that one of the things that really, one of the feelings or memories that comes up for me around eating as a little girl was the disparate, and I hear adult kids of alcoholics talk about this a lot. I'm also sober. I don't have alcoholic parents, although there's ism in the sort of periphery of my family, but it's that same experience of the my internal reality and the reality of what I saw going on in my family. And then the way it was processed, talked about, and the way that I felt I was supposed to present myself to the world were so far apart that I had to put something in me to deal with that tension. You know, my parents, I grew up in a really small town, like 3,000 people in Idaho. And my parents both taught in the public schools there, and it's a very tight-knit community, and it was very lovely and a great place to grow up, but what I knew was that my parents were supposed to be role models, and that they talked about other people's parents and how weird they were, and like, we weren't supposed to be weird, and I was supposed to be good, and like, all this stuff, and then, you know, you go to bed at night and mom and dad are screaming at each other, and then in the morning you wake up and everybody sits down for breakfast and it's all nobody said anything. I'd be like, what, you guys were screaming at each other all night. We're not going to talk about it? Like, now I'm supposed to just go to school and like have a nice day? Like how, I didn't understand how to process that. And that was really my first sort of foray into compulsion, was dealing with the anxiety that created in me as a little kid. So the eating started really young, I think it was always there. But I remember specifically like binging when I was probably eight or nine years old. And I have this memory, I was thinking, spending the night at my friend's house, probably like in second grade or something, and the big deal was I was going to go spend the night on Friday night, and her mom was going to make us Red Snapper. I didn't know what Red Snapper was, but it sounded really sexy. And like, I was really like, all week long, I was like, Eve's mom is making us Red Snapper. I have no idea what that is, but I can't wait to get to Eve's house. And I thought it was going to be, my mom was also completely like, granola before her time. Like, there was no sugar in our house. Everything was carob this and molasses that and whole wheat this, and it was sucked as a kid. And so I was really psyched about this whole Red Snapper idea. And lo and behold, you know, it's fish, if you guys didn't know that. And, like, it's not exactly an 8-year-old's idea of, like, an awesome dinner. You know? I remember being so devastated that, like, I wanted to go home. I started to cry. I didn't know then, like, how I was going to manage to have a nice night. You know? And, like, I was too embarrassed to actually say, like, I need to go home because I'm so upset about the red snapper. So I just, like, again, holding on to those feelings and, like, not having anywhere to take them and not feeling that I had any room to have an authentic emotional experience. Because I think I sensed even then that my emotional life was like, that it wasn't normal. You know, and that it wasn't safe to go around telling people the truth about what was going on inside, because they were going to think I was crazy. And it went on like that, you know? So the obsession around, I always felt fat as a kid too. And I maybe was like a little sort of plumpy, not even. I mean, I look at pictures of me now as a kid, and I looked like a normal kid. Like, there's nothing, I don't see a chubby kid, I don't see a fat kid, I see a kid. But I don't know, I've always felt conscious of being bigger. That same friend, actually, Eve, I remember being devastated that I couldn't borrow her jeans in, like, third grade, because she was built like a boy. And I was never really built like that, even as a little kid. And my mom, actually, who we'll get to her, but she still says things to me like, God, when I had you, and when I had your sister, it was hard to get the head out. Once the head was out, she just came out and everything was fine. And then with you, I got her head out, and then come your shoulders, and then, my God, girl, your hips. I was as an infant, you know, like, already. The family story is that I'm the, you know, the curvy one, or the one with childbearing hips. Or whatever. I mean, the thing, and my grandmother has actually said that to me. I'm sorry you got my hips, honey, she'll say. So the, you know, the crazy obsessive body stuff is a really big part of my family story as well. So in high school, which was more in junior high really, I had kind of a period where I, you know, adolescence kind of kicked in, and I was actually was having a lot of fun. I was pretty popular. Like, junior high was not traumatic for me. There were lots of boys and parties, and it was all good. And I don't remember feeling particularly food obsessed, although I did used to always throw away the lunch that my mom packed for me and steal money from my dad to buy lunch at school because it was fattier and tastier and grosser and all that stuff that I really wanted. So it was still going on, but it wasn't making me insane. And my body wasn't really showing signs of, you know, like, you wouldn't know from the outside if I was nuts. And then I had a traumatic sexual experience when I was 14. I just turned 14. And I couldn't tell anybody. And again, if that's, you know, being as sick as our secrets, I couldn't tell. And I knew it was like, oh my God, I'm so dirty and wrong and awful, and, you know, I can't tell them, they'll hate me, I don't know what I thought they would do. I thought that they would know that it was my fault. I knew it was my fault, right? I don't know why we do that to ourselves, or how that idea comes in, but I knew it was my fault. And I couldn't tell my parents, and I couldn't tell anybody. I couldn't even tell my girlfriends, you know? And so the food was like my best friend again, right away. And I gained 50 pounds in like less than a year, maybe like 6 months, I put on 50 pounds. And the family went nuts. It was like, they had no, and it wasn't like, wow, kiddo, like, what's wrong? Is something going on with you? It was like, why are you gaining weight? And you will exercise every day. And this is not acceptable in our family. And like, really, there was a lot of craziness around how things appeared on the outside. And then, and this is where the story diverges a little bit, at around 16, I'd had enough. I'd had enough of being home alone on a Saturday night, eating my face off, thank you, fat as all get out. I'd had enough. And so I started drinking and smoking cigarettes and doing drugs. And it was like nirvana. I didn't have to eat anymore. So alcoholism and drug addiction and nicotine addiction really became my cure for compulsive overeating until I got sober at age 29. So we can just fast forward about 13 years. So now we're getting to the what happened part. The what happened part was I got sober. And I stayed sober long enough that smoking cigarettes no longer worked for me. Now, I could binge a little bit, like enough to take the edge off and eat sugar, enough to take the edge off and smoke so many cigarettes. I smoked like a pack and a half, 2 packs a day. Like there was never not a cigarette in my mouth. I could work out enough, you know, coughing all the way, to keep my body down to a somewhat normal body size. Like I definitely have body dysmorphia. I don't know what size. I mean, I know what size I am because I know what size pants I buy, but I don't know what that means. And I think it means something. I'm pretty sure it means something about me, but I'm never quite sure. On any given day, it can mean something different. But what happened really was that I stayed sober long enough to put down the cigarettes. And oh my God, you guys, it was like some devil came in and took over my body and took me to Vaughn's. And it was bad, and I couldn't stop going to Vaughn's like every single night. I was in grad school at UCLA, and I would be coming home from rehearsal at like 11:30 midnight, right? Knowing I had to get up at 6:30 or 7 to get back to school the next day, working harder than I ever had at something that I really wanted. And I'd be like driving home, I'm not going to go to Vaughn's, I'm not going to go to Vaughn's, I'm not going to go to Vaughn's. And then I'd go to Vaughn's and binge. And I was seeing my body go again. You know, I could, every day, I could feel it getting bigger. I was getting bigger, and digestively, it was all screwed up, and then I couldn't stop doing it in front of other people. That's when it really got scary. Like, I'd sit down to eat with my classmates or my castmates at a show, and I would not be able to, like, I'd get a huge portion at some restaurant, and I would not be able to stop when it was appropriate, and I'd have to finish my whole plate, and then your plate, and then probably ask the waiter for a side of something, and I could see them looking at me like, girlfriend, like clearly you probably ought to lose 10 or 15 anyway, and this is not good. You know, I felt so ashamed, and so I knew where to go. Although, man, I didn't want to come here. I really wanted AA to solve this thing for me. I really did. I was fine being an alcoholic because it was fucking sexy and whatever. Being a compulsive overeater is not sexy. So I went to my first meeting. I went to the 1 o'clock meeting at Forbes Hall. And I just cried. I just sat in the meeting, and I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried and cried and cried. After the meeting, this lovely, like, woman came up to me, and Sharon, she was my first sponsor, and she said, honey, tell me what's going on. And I just, I can't stop eating, blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, what is it? Like, what is the thing that's really getting you? And I said, it's sugar. Like, I can't stop eating sugar. And she said, okay, cool. Today, no sugar. That's it. You can come to my house. You can sleep there. You can do whatever you need to do. But just for today, how about no sugar? And I thought, okay. Like, something's got to give, you know? So I was able to get abstinent off of sugar right away from that day. I actually haven't had recreational sugar on purpose, like gone out and had ice cream or cakes or cookies or since that day. Which I forget what a miracle that is, because everything else feels so unclear and unclean sometimes that I can tell myself like that I have no recovery and no abstinence. But from that day on, I didn't have any sugar, and I started to have lots of other stuff. It got big again, you know, like it got all kinds of crazy. But I haven't left OA since. And for me, a big part of my abstinence and what I, what's important to me is that I don't leave. Interestingly, I chose a sponsor who was so involved, like really, really good, beautiful woman. She's still one of my best friends, but she didn't really mind if I didn't work the steps. And I don't know, because I had already worked him in another program, and you know, it just wasn't, there wasn't a real onus on step work. And that was great, because I didn't really want to look at much of it anyway. So it worked. It really did work for me. I think I needed that for a while. I needed that really sort of gentle, like sort of anything goes as long as you don't do X, Y, or Z thing for a while. And actually that was maybe, gosh, almost 2 years like that. And then what happened was that I wasn't free. I wasn't getting free. And I wanted, you know, it was like, it's weird because I have such an all or nothing brain, and I think the alcoholic in me is so all or nothing. Like, I don't call my sponsor before I drink a beer and then call her after I drink the beer and say, okay, I'm done with my one beer. Like, that's retarded. And so sometimes in LA I go, this is so weird to me. I still don't get it. Like, what do you mean I'm supposed to, like, check in about my meals? And, like, I don't weigh and measure, so there's room for things to get funky. And what I'm finding is that for me in this program, it has absolutely been an inside job. And the recovery that shows up in the way that I eat is because I've worked stuff out on the inside. Now, that's not to say that when things aren't funky, I look at what I'm eating and I clean it up so that I can get to what's on the inside. You know, there's a real relationship for me there, but I do not have the kind of abstinence that I tell myself that other people have, and maybe they do, and it's really none of my business, but where I say, no X, Y, Z, period, this, that, the other, no matter what, you know, end of story, I'll go to any lengths not to eat an extra bite or whatever, you know. It's not my abstinence. What I have found is that the recovery has been spiritual, and it has been a process of accepting myself for who I am, start to finish, with all of the stuff that comes with, and to not judge myself and my life based on what size my jeans are, what I ate yesterday, what I'm going to eat later today, what size your jeans are, and, you know, am I smaller than her or bigger than, you know, that really, I mean, you guys know, that took up like 99% of my mental energy for so long, where it was like, am I fat or am I skinny? Am I fat or am I skinny? Am I fat or am I, like, come on. Like, there was no room for anything else. And I really have a lot of freedom from that today. A lot of freedom from that. A surprising amount of freedom from that. I don't really think about my body unless something else is going on. It's like, it's not my main focus, and I'm not that interested in it. I'm just really not. I think that a lot of it is about, I was also an actor for many years, and that's been a big OA journey for me. Was part of, I mean, one of the things that sort of drove me here, aside from just the desperation of not being able to not eat another pint of ice cream another night in a row, was that it was brought to my attention over and over and over that I was too fat to work. And I don't know if anybody else is here in the business. They don't say it nicely. They say you're too fat to work. And I would hear this information, and I would spin into such suicidal depression. And I was so angry with God, because I thought, like, okay, on the one hand, you blessed me with this talent, and you gave me this passion, and you gave me this drive. It's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. I'm really good at it, and I know I'm really good at it. And everybody tells me, you're really good at it, but you're too fat to work. And if you just lose weight, you'd be kicking ass out there, girl. And I'd be like, I can't. Like, how do I explain that to you people? I can't. And I was so pissed off. I felt like it was a real, and I still struggle with this spiritually. I feel like when I get in a place spiritually where I'm feeling unfit or ungrateful, I think that God is pulling the old, I like to call it the bait and switch. Where, like, it's going to be this way, and look how nice it is, and you're going to have this, and it's going to be that, and then, ha, 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 never mind, like, it's all screwed up, you're just fat, he sucks, he doesn't love you anyway, you're not going to get the job, blah, blah, blah. And I take it so personally, and I get so hurt by it, and I go, excuse me, God, that was, like, the meanest schoolyard trick, and how dare you behave like that? And then I have to, like, step back from that and go, like, okay, hang on. I know God doesn't behave like that. the God of my understanding loves me infinitely. And there's nothing in that equation that spells infinite love. So what I'm calling God is really something else, right? It's my expectations, it's my psychology, it's my, you know, it's my tendency to be over-emotional, it's my oversensitivity, it's whatever it is, but it's not God. Coming to an a surrender to the world, like the world as it is, like I don't really have it in, like I'm not really interested in being some trailblazing, like I can make it in Hollywood in the body that I have and look at me and, you know, changing things for women. I wish I had that in me. I don't. And I made a decision to give it up, to walk away from that dream, because I could no longer handle it. I couldn't be told one more time, you're too fat. And I really had to ask myself if the cost of what that was costing me on an emotional level, what that was costing me in terms of how I saw the world, like is the world a loving place where everything and anything is possible? Or is the world something that's going to limit me and make me feel bad about myself? And like, what am I choosing to participate in? And I really sort of just came to the decision that I was no longer willing to participate in conversations that were that hurtful. And if that meant that I wasn't going to go on auditions, it meant I wasn't going to go on auditions. Like, it was just, it got really clear for me all of a sudden. Now, it's not to say that the process of extricating myself from that dream and from that life wasn't difficult. It was. It took like a year of sort of heart-wrenching willingness, I guess. But what's been really interesting is on the other side of it, I can't tell you that I did not give a rat's ass. I actually called my agent, my commercial agent, who I was still hanging on to, and said, just take me off your roster because I don't care. Like, I don't want to go. I don't want to do that work. I don't care. It's like I feel completely free and like open to other possibilities and open to a whole other profession that I've discovered that I love, that I'm really good at, that I keep getting like raises and accolades and get, you know, like I'm having success for the first time in my life on a professional basis. And it's all part of surrendering to the what is. You know, I was so attached to the way that I thought my life had to look, and I couldn't see the forest for the trees. So that kind of takes me up to, like, what is life like today? Life is really great. I have recommitted to OA, to a new sponsor, to really getting in there and working the steps, to the best of my ability, not hiding from who I am when I'm standing in front of the refrigerator, which I still am ashamed sometimes of that girl and what goes through her head and how she feels about herself. And what sometimes, you know, the idea of what I will, and I don't do the behavior, you know, so there's the recovery, but sometimes it's so overwhelming to think of, like, how powerful the disease is and how willing I am to throw away every shred of self-respect I have for a cookie. You know, it's a really humbling thing. I want to tell you guys the story because it just cracks my shit up, but so a lot of the recovery for me too has been about family stuff and about getting to a place where, like, my new paradigm for my family is that it's my job to be of loving service to every member of my family whenever I possibly can. And that's it. I could give, you know, the rest of it is like history, it's done, it's over, and it doesn't matter. My job is to be of loving service to them. My mom and I have had this, you know, from the get-go, that feeling of not being able to tell them the truth of who I was, of then taking care of myself in the only way that I knew how, which was with food, and then being punished for the outward signs of that self-care, which was also unacceptable. I carried that around as a real, like, F you back to my parents for a long time. And I'm now to a place where when my mom does her funny things, like she still likes to check what size jeans I'm wearing, like when I go home to visit. Like I'll walk into the room where I'm staying and there she'll be looking at the size of my jeans. Because she's got to know. She's got to know, is my child okay? Or really, she has to know, am I okay? Is she okay as a mom? And for her, the way she knows that is if I'm in an acceptable body size. So that's her stuff, right? The disease doesn't just come out of nowhere. It's like, well, where do you think I got it? You know? It just shows up differently for her. So Easter weekend, I went home to see my family. And we do this weird thing around food where my whole family, very fit, very health conscious, skinny little jerks, people. But we do this thing, right, around the dinner table where it's like, you can't leave food, right? Like, if it's like a couple bites of whatever the dish is, like, God forbid, it just go in the disposal or like to, like down the garbage. It's like, there has to be this whole discussion about, well, you should finish it. No, you finish it. No, I don't want it. No, you should. Oh, you should finish it. Well, it's just two bites. You finish it. Right? This goes on and on and on and on. So this is happening at the table with this, I don't know, it's like chicken or something. And my sister says to me, well, Amy, why don't you finish it? And my mom doesn't miss a beat. She goes, well, don't encourage her. And I was like, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I would have been so angry about that and so hurt by that. And I would have cried about it secretly or maybe even to her, although I never really took this stuff to her. And it made me laugh. It made me, like, I started laughing so hard. And my sister, she catches on, right? She gets it. So she's laughing so hard. We both, like, have tears streaming down our face. And my mom's like, what? What's so funny? I'm like, really? I mean, don't encourage her? That's funny. So I guess all I really want to say is that I don't understand really how recovery works. My experience has been that it's a process of like persistent consistence and re-surrendering all the time and becoming more and more willing to tell the truth and to not filter the truth so that I can hang on to my behavior. You know, I'm really good at telling you what I'm doing, but telling you it in a way that you're not really going to tell me to stop doing it, even though it's killing me. And kind of being willing to let go of that stuff and to just to give over to the knowledge that there's a power greater than me who is infinite love and who has a design not for my life so much but for my soul. And so all the stuff that manifests in my life is just I just think, wow, my soul is trying to grow me today. That must be what's going on. On days that feel uncomfortable or even days that feel joyous. I mean, it's all really just a lesson. This is a real miracle of OA and recovery that I didn't tell you the story you want me to tell. Damn it. I totally forgot. Okay. Couple stories. So, these are great because this is how God has worked in since I got sober and then abstinent. This is how God has worked for me. When I was first getting sober, I had about December 16th is my sobriety date and my abstinence date. Actually, I slipped on my AA birthday, and then so I guess the next day, the 17th, is my OA date. So I was one out for one day. But when I was, that first year of sobriety, so I had 2 weeks sober, it's New Year's Eve, and I'm a bartender in Brooklyn. And my addictions are not pretty, and they don't come in light forms, okay? I was a daily drinker. I drank till I passed out every day for 10 years. And there I am, 2 weeks off of alcohol, and I'm still detoxing. And I have, like, this ache in my spine like you will not believe. And I know this is AA stuff, but it's God stuff, so I'm going to feel free to share it. My skin is crawling. My spine hurts. I can't really see. But at the time, I didn't have enough recovery to know I didn't really have to go to work, right? I thought I had to go to work, come hell or high water. So I'm going to go bartend on New Year's Eve. So, A, nobody knows I'm in AA, because God forbid, right? And so that I can pretend to you, to myself, to other people that I'm okay, that I can hold it together, whatever it is. I need money. You know, I'll tell myself all these stories. So I remember being in my apartment and just sobbing and getting down on my knees and just asking God, like, just, I don't know how I'm going to do this. I can feel, the shot is already in my mouth. You know, I'm screwed here. But I'm going to go into this bar and I'm going to work tonight. So please help me. And it was like, I walked in the door of that place at like 7 o'clock at night and I worked until 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was like being in some kind of bizarre space bubble. It was like, I was untouchable. I was there, and I was doing, it was really busy, I was working, people were getting hammered all around me. This is a bar, but I worked there for 5 years, and I was known for being like the girl to get down with, because I was like out of my mind. And it was like I was in this strange little God-shaped orb, you know, and I just like floated through my shift, and I walked out of there at 5 o'clock in the morning, just like, I can't believe it. And I stayed up and went to like a 6:30 in the morning meeting. And I knew then that like miracles were possible. If that was possible, anything was possible. And the other story I'll tell really quick is that when I had then fast forward, so I had about, this is definitely what it was like, I had about 60 days sober, and I was eating a ton. And lots and lots and lots and lots of sugar. But I was losing like 3 or 4 pounds a day. Like literally. And I was like, if this is what sobriety is like, this rocks. And I was eating and eating and eating, getting thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. And then my ribs are showing and people are concerned. And ooh, all of a sudden I don't feel so good. And I can only give it the stares and what's going on. And I thought I was crazy. Right? I didn't trust my body. I thought, well, I'm just nuts. And I ended up in the emergency room, and they put me right in ICU, and I was diagnosed with late-onset type 1 diabetes as a result of drinking, right, as a result of eating out of control for years, as a result of also my genetics and some weird autoimmune stuff, but all of those things played a part. But the craziness is that I was willing to ignore what my body was telling me for like a month as I went from like 150 pounds down to 115. And I thought, this kicks ass. That's what I thought. This is really awesome. My organs were shutting down. And I was so psyched that for the first time in my life, I was a size 4. That's all I cared about. So to go from that to where I am today, where I have a real... Not that I don't let myself get uncomfortable before I do something about stuff. I still, like, let's say everything I let go of has claw marks in it to varying degrees, but I don't throw myself away like that. I don't throw myself away for a pair of jeans. I don't throw myself away for a cookie. I don't throw myself away for a guy. I don't throw myself away. To be able to do that is... I attribute all of that to OA, to the 12 steps, to my higher power. Okay, I'd be happy to take questions or whatever. Hi.
From your share, mm-hmm. What are you doing daily basically to your higher power?
I pray and meditate every day. So for me, it's a morning. I need to do it in the morning. I still, not that, you know the feeling of waking up like the house is on fire, right? It's like, I'm awake, something has already gone wrong. And anxiety, lots of anxiety. And I never know, am I anxious because I'm depressed or am I depressed because I'm anxious? They're very tied for me. I think the anxiety is, for me, the more root thing. So I got to work on my anxiety first thing in the morning. So I do get a cup of coffee first. And then... I sit with a daily meditation book of some sort, some program literature, either OA or AA. I have a place in my house. Ritual is really important to me. And it has become important in recovery because the idea of getting down on my knees to pray was so powerful and actually changing my physical position and having a physical position that was used only for, right, was really important to me. And so I have a place in my house and a little rug that I sit on, and it's really simple. I just read a little literature, I pray. I always, always, always say the third step prayer. It's just my favorite. And then whatever else I need to say, I say to God. I have a really fluid kind of conversation, I guess, with God. I don't adhere to any, like, I can't ask for anything specific. Or, I mean, if I feel like I need to ask something specific, I just ask for it. I mean, I'm going to get it, right? Like, I'm not in charge here. It's not like if I pray wrong, you know, like, that's going to change the result. It's about getting to know myself and being honest with myself and connecting. And then I just sit and listen. So for me, meditation is when I receive. So I consciously ask to be in a receptive state, and I just sit in quiet. And one of the coolest meditations that I learned from a fellow was to just, on my inhale, to say, "I love you, Amy," and on my exhale, to say, "I love you, God." And it's simple, and it's profound, and it's powerful, and it really centers me. So I do that for a while until I can just be still and just be quiet. And then I just let myself be still and quiet. And I can meditate. Now I have to set a timer, because otherwise I'll just sit there. So, and I couldn't do it for 1 minute when I first started trying. I was too squirrely. So I, 10 or 15 minutes, depending on how early I get my butt out of bed every day. All right.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you make the journey from kind of the punishing God? Or I guess, how did you get to a place where you were able to, like, you know, be able to see your God in, like, a different way? Because I understand I'm kind of going back and forth with that.
Mm-hmm. My first sponsor, this was in AA. Although she's also, I wasn't in OA at the time, but she was, go figure, asked me to write a description of God the way that I would write a request for the best boyfriend. Mm-hmm. Like, if God could be anything that I wanted God to be, with no restrictions, no limitations, I don't have to get anybody's permission for God to be like that. I just get to choose. What would God look like? And I just sort of created this idea. And at the time, it was somebody I could, like, I don't mean this in the way it's going to sound, somebody I could be in my undies with. I mean, in the spiritual sense, like my spiritual undies, you know, and just be like hanging out and have a really loose and easy conversation with. But the thing that was the most important thing for me about defining my higher power was that I could let go of all the responsibility. I know that sounds weird, but I couldn't have any responsibility for my life. Because my best thinking got me, well, first fat, and then drunk, and then fat again, right? Like, and crazy, and in the food, and self-destructive, and manic, and, you know, alone, and all of those things. And it wasn't like I ever said, "Oh, screw it, I'm just going to be, I'm just going to mess up my life. I'm just going to be, you know, whatever it is that I was." You know, I was really trying to put a life together. And that was the result I was getting. So it was key for me that I needed to be able to give over control. And that I needed to be able to say, okay, if I get to a meeting today, and I stay sober today, and I stay abstinent today, and I do one or two things to be of service, if at all possible, everything else is God's business. Everything else. Because I don't want to be in charge of my bank account. I don't want to be in charge of my job. I don't want to be in charge of my relationships. Like, I can't do it. And the thought that I have to do it is so frightening to me that it'll send me out. So key for me is that I can be, like, in God's hands. Okay. Thank you.